Welcome to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. Dr. Williams is the author of the acclaimed book, Shattered by the Darkness, Putting the Pieces Back Together After Child Abuse. Dr. Williams is on the senior leadership team at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And Dr. Williams travels the United States speaking and training professionals, parents, and victims about the importance of dealing with abuse and personal trauma head on and not being afraid to break the silence of your own personal pain. Feel free to call in to tonight's show at 888-627-6008 and speak with Dr. Williams and his guests live on air. And now, your host, Dr. Williams.
Good evening, folks. Welcome to what I believe is the most beautiful city in our country, Houston, Texas. It's the most awesome in my eyes. And I'm right here at the Texas Medical Center. And you can see right behind me the sun going down and the actual places that I work at. I work right here on the 10th floor. And the sun is just now fading away here. Our guest tonight, I believe, is going to be on the other side of the country in California, but I'm going to make sure if that's still where our guest is from tonight when he comes on. It's been great to be with you this month. Can you believe we're on the last Sunday of July already, and the year's halfway over, more than halfway over, and I can't even, they're talking about Christmas. It just, what's going on in our world? Things seems, you know, somebody told me I had a birthday yesterday. I turned 63 years old. I never thought that I would make 50, but at 63 years old, that's, I don't know, one of those days that you look and go, okay, well, that's great, and you just move on. But, you know, birthdays and events like that, and we're going to talk about that a little bit at the intro of this here shortly, can bring good memories, can also bring bad memories. And we're going to talk about some of the good and the bad tonight with our guest. If you want to get involved, we'd love for you to get involved with us tonight. You can do it in three different ways. You can call 888-627-6008. And one of the most awesome radio hosts in the world, Thomas, is right there. And he will answer the phone and patch you right through to me and our guest tonight. Or you can get on, we are on, Shattered by the Darkness Facebook page. I'm looking at it right here. You can post a little question there. Or my personal cell phone number is 832-396-6525. And that goes right here. You can text me during the show and during our commercial break at the bottom of the hour. I'll be glad to get on there and read your comment or your question for our guest. And, you know, we started something a week or so ago when Diana and Micah Lassert was on the program, and they have a great book, and it's right here on my desk, The Breaker, and it's doing really good in the world of authors and Barnes and Nobles and places like that. But it's doing, The Breaker's an awesome book. But we were talking about when we opened up that show a week or so ago, I was starting to talk about things to help you deal with what's happened to you. How do you get over something that traumatic has got into your attic and start messing up things? I'm talking about your mental attic. What do you do? And I had a whole list of like 15, but I only got through one. And I'm only going to try to get through maybe one or two tonight because I want to get to our guests tonight. But we talked about the first thing you really need to do. And I'm interested in what our author tonight has to say about this. But the first thing we need to do is tell yourself the truth. Not hold it back. Not hide it. Admit what happened. Also in that realm, admit that it wasn't your fault. Accept that you're not to blame, that something happened to you if you're in one of those situations of abuse or domestic violence or something of that order, human trafficking. And so we talked about that for quite a while. Tell yourself the truth. Another bit of wisdom that I'd like to be able to share with you is number two, is you have to separate yourself from your experiences. So whatever happened to you is not your identity. You have to separate that. You experienced abuse, but you are not the abuse. And I know in the book that we're going to be featuring tonight, I've read several times that you have to deal with this, and that's such a true a statement. And replacing what's wrong with me with what's happened to me, and how and what kind of support do I need to be able to get through it? And that is so important, to separate your identity from your experience, because that's not you. That's something that you have gone through. And it doesn't ID you. It's not who you are. It may have formed you. It may have shaped you. It may have molded the way you respond and react. And next week or the week after, we're going to be talking about triggers in a major way. I shower, just I showered just a while ago. And the way I shower is from what happened to me as a child. The way I got dressed this morning was formed by the way I was abused all my childhood as a kid. And there's some things that it does affect, but it is not me. That's not me. I am far beyond what happened to me. And to be honest with you, now looking back on it, because of those things, it made me stronger, it made me better, and it also gave me a purpose in life that I can use all that negativity that so many people wanted to bury me with and use it to help people. And I've got a feeling our guests may have a thought about that too. Let's do one more. You got to break the silence safely. When you decide that it's time to tell, that it's time to come out and not only tell yourself the truth, but you want other people to know what that truth is. Be careful with that. It's important that you do it, but you have to find someone that you trust. I always recommend when I counsel people that they get a journal, write those things down, and in that journal, eventually, when you have somebody, it could be a significant other, it could be a spouse, it could be a counselor, it could be a pastor, it could be a teacher, it could be a boss at work, whoever it is, with somebody that you fully trust. A friend of yours, somebody that you really believe in, and they believe in you. Maybe just open up your journal and say, "Hey, can I share this one paragraph?" You don't have to share the whole journal with them, because there's a lot of private stuff in those journals. And then take that journal back and say, "I just wanted to let you know that, and I trust you. I respect you enough to want to share a darkness inside of me that I need to get out and feel safe to be able to tell somebody else." And in that, that can put balm, ointment, healing salve on the pain, because if you don't, that secret can become literally a prison. And I've lived inside that prison, and it's lonely in there. But once you let somebody in and you find out that they don't push you away, that they'll believe you, they don't doubt the story, they don't question your manhood, they don't question, everything else that you wonder if they're going to even like me anymore. And when you find that out, it automatically not only releases baggage, it builds up something inside, a resilience inside of us that is like, wow, That was better than I thought. And I think just opening that door and allowing somebody into your heart. And I know what trust is all about. And I know what trust issues are all about. Let's face it. If you've been hurt, you've been betrayed, you've been abused, you've been neglected, you've been, beat on or whatever. Trust is huge. And I don't trust very many people. But when you allow that little piece of that silence being shared, it can make a load of difference. We're going to get to the other 11 of these as we go each week. And then maybe we'll do a program on just all 15 real quick so you can get them all at one time. But that's just a couple of things that I wanted to share with you. Got a busy week. Going to be doing a keynote speech in Fort Bend this week. Going to also come back that afternoon and do another huge with the DCF workers in Texas. They're having a big conference and going to be sharing with them some things about vicarious trauma and how to deal with your own ACEs in your life. And when they're dealing with clients all day long, what kind of triggers does that bring up inside of them? So anyway, that's just a few things I want to share with you tonight. 888-627-6008. I am so anxious and I want to apologize publicly and on air that yes, Greg Williams made a mistake last week that our author, and go ahead and TJ, bring him into the side here with me. You're looking at Tim Smith. He is an author of a book called Fault Line, FAULT Line, Fault Line. And that's going to be my first question, Tim, just to kind of give you a secret. What's the title mean? Last week we were supposed to have him on the program and I committed to him and I apparently didn't write it down in my calendar book. And I was focused on everybody in the world on this side of the world. The other side of the world is going to be watching soccer and in that World Cup championship match. And I failed to let him know. And he was probably sitting right there where he is tonight, waiting for me to tap into him. So I'm so sorry, Tim. But welcome to the program tonight. I'm so glad we finally got connected up.
Thank you, Greg. I'm glad to be here.
How's everything going
And
with you?
it's going well. First, I'd like to say a happy belated birthday to you.
Thank you.
And secondly, LA may give Houston a run for its money for most beautiful city.
Really awesome.
LA is a very beautiful city. It has a lot to offer. It has its problems, but it definitely has a lot
No,
to
we all.
offer.
Yeah, they all do. I was out in LA not too long ago. Went to see America's Got Talent and landed there in Long Beach and then experienced LA and Hollywood and all that. And it's a beautiful, beautiful town. Welcome to the program.
Thank
And
you.
tell me just a little bit about yourself before we get into the book, what you do. And I have here that you grew up in rural South. And in an environment of addiction, instability, neglect. And I want to go down and drill down as deep into that as what you feel comfortable with. But you went pretty deep in your story about all that. So, what made you decide now is the time to write the book?
My name is Tim Smith. I'm author of Fault Line, Still Standing. I'm from Pensacola, Florida. Kind of around the corner from you there in Houston, so to speak. And it just ended up, I knew the book was in me for a while. The story kind of nagged at me for at least a decade. And I'd had therapy for about 3 years and had initially started therapy for one other sort of issue. And, maybe our third visit, he had asked, "How was your childhood?" And anytime anyone asked me that, I immediately clam up, arms crossed. "It was fine. How was yours?" And, that's kind of it. And as we kind of got into things, I started to realize like there were some issues and there were some problems within there that I think I had not really acknowledge. They were more facts for me or more events, but I didn't really attach any emotion to it because I think my mind was probably trying to protect me from that.
So you compartmentalized what was going on and you did your own thing, but when did you start tying in that what you're experiencing later in life could be placed back into what happened to you in your childhood? How many years did it take you to be able to go, hey, wait, maybe
Oh,
that's because of this?
gosh, Greg, 45 years, 50 years, you
Wow,
know? I mean, and
beat
it
my
wasn't like,
record.
and it wasn't like I was hiding from it or in denial of it. I just didn't acknowledge it. It was just not a part of me, you know? Like, I think my mind had done such a good job of trying to protect me from the trauma and trying to keep me safe from that and trying to keep my mind from being focused on that. And one time in therapy, we started to talk about the event when my mother kidnapped me from my dad when I was 6 years old. And that is sort of the title of the book and why I call it Fault Line, because that was the fault line event in my life. Like, that is where I can trace everything back to sort of where it all started, right? And so that was sort of the earthquake event. And so it kind of started with her kidnapping me. And when I was talking to the therapist about it, he was like, it's facts for you. There's no emotion attached to it. And, you know, I had not come to that conclusion. And we talked about it and we really kind of went deep into it. And I had really, I don't say regressed, you know, I don't know if that is really the right word, but, you know, all of a sudden that memory that I had not, you know, pulled, you know, old in 45, 47 years was all of a sudden very vivid. And in a way, it almost sort of, you know, the way the dam will open up and a little bit of water comes out in a little bit. And then all of a sudden, it all kind of came to me. It all just kind of came to me in a rush.
Do you remember what event it was that you remembered? Or for me, it was a holiday. For me, it was, that time of the year. And then when I thought about that and started thinking about that, like, oh my God, every day after. Do you remember what exactly point in your childhood that you remembered and you said, wait, then it spirals to other things and then it gets bigger, 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 and you got a whole story.
Absolutely. It almost is almost like a spoke or a spiral on the wheel, right? So like I see the fault line, I see that event, and then like, oh, that, and then that, and then that, and, you know, and sort of goes deeper and deeper almost into like an onion. And even as like I was writing the book Fault Line, there were things that would come in a rush or in a flash that I was just shocked, you know, I was really shocked by some of it. And then there were some things that I would remember after the book was written or would come to me, you know, maybe in more detail or came as sort of a new memory that just had not been there for me before.
One thing that I've really noticed and to be honest with you, really enjoyed in the book was that you would tap into you write kind of like I write because you would go through an experience and you go, well, I was going through this and what was going on, I was listening to this song. And then you threw in the song and the writer, a Meatloaf song or
Right.
something like that. It's like, wow, wait, I remember that. And did that come immediately or when you started thinking about all of these things and specifically shining the light on the incident, you start smelling things, you start seeing what the wallpaper looked like. The time of day, and it just all started what was on TV and everything.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. So I'm a photographer, and so I'm a visual person. You know, I love, you know, video and images. And so for me, when I see those images of childhood in my mind, they say a word or a picture is worth a thousand words. You know, for me, the picture, like all of the data lives in the image in my mind, all of the emotion, all of the data, all of the smells, the sound, that song. And like that particular song, like that Meatloaf 2 out of 3 ain't bad song, like I remember them playing that like over and over again on that 8-track. And like I can
Eight
smell the,
tracks.
yes, yeah, that's how old I am. Like that's how old I am.
Me
And
too.
like I could still smell the humidity in that place, you know, and like the floors creaked. And it was just, you know, I kind of hated, I remember being, you know, a child, I didn't like that house, because it was there were roaches in it. And it wasn't cool, and it was hot, and it just felt always dirty, and but that song definitely, like, anytime I hear it, I am swallowed back to that place immediately.
I was getting ready to ask you. So, if you're listening, you're driving to LA, going to do a photography shoot, and you're listening to the classic rock radio or whatever, and Meatloaf comes on, does your mind automatically boom?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
Do
I
you go
can't
straight to
even.
the event when it does? I mean, do you go, there I was, that was the day, that's what.
I the only the best way I can describe it, and I wish I could show it to you in my head. I am almost about my head's almost like at the couch, right? Like I'm almost like a little boy in the floor with them, and like I'm almost at their feet and their legs, right? And that's playing over here on the stereo, and they're probably either smoking a joint or smoking a cigarette, and like I just kind of remember being there between them and feeling that there was something sad and final about whatever it was that they were experiencing. Like I remember really it feeling like an ending for them. It almost felt like an ending to them, and I couldn't explain it. And I certainly didn't understand it as a little boy.
Now, when your mom kidnapped you, and you're 6 years old, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Kidnap is a harsh word.
Yeah.
Was it where she grabbed you in the middle of the night, threw you in the car, and snuck out, or was it, hey, come on, honey, we're going for a drive, and you just never came back?
Correct.
Help our listeners to figure out that haven't read the book. Was anything going on prior to that? Was there abuse going on with her and I guess your dad before she decided to kidnap you? And why did she leave?
Yeah, so she was crafty about it. I will give her this. And then one thing that I do want to bring up about the kidnapping or the word kidnapping, I had never associated that word with what had happened. In my mind, she had just taken me from my dad.
Yeah.
And my husband has a master's in social work. He used to run the department here in LA County. And so, he's got some insights to some of my, nonsense, right? And so I was telling him about it one time, and he said, "Oh yeah, so she kidnapped you." And I was like, "No, she just took me against my will and kept me hidden from my dad for a year." And he said, "Maybe that's kidnapping, right?" And
Yeah.
then it was almost like I'd had this epiphany, this realization that I was kidnapped by my mother, and that was very like jarring to my psyche in a way, honestly. Like I was like, oh, that's unsettling, and now I've got to kind of process that, right? And so the morning of the kidnapping, I remember her waking me up and taking me, waking me up to go to school. My mother never did that. Through all of my childhood, once I was gone from my dad, she never woke me up for school. I don't recall her making breakfast. I don't recall her sending me to school with lunch. I don't remember any of that. And there's proof of that later because I ended up getting on like free lunch and free breakfast programs because she was so neglectful. And so she told me to go, give my dad a kiss goodbye. It was morning time, and I think he had probably been laying out the night before. He smelled stale. He smelled like beer and cigarettes in Florida. He just smelled. But that was my daddy, right? I'm a little boy, and it's okay, so I kiss him goodbye, and we're walking, and she says, "What if we don't go to school today?" And I was like, I'm six. This sounds great. Like, what are we going to do, And she's just kind of holding my hand, and in the corner, there's this parking lot. I see it vividly now. There's a gas station parking lot. It's almost in like a triangle shape, and my soon-to-be stepfather had a gold Chevy Nova. Jacked up tires in the back, big blower in the front, very, let's just call it white trash because that's what it was, okay? And so I saw that, and all of a sudden, and I'll still do it now when I get nervous or scared, I get that in my tummy where it's like it's being punched, you're being pulled, and I just knew something was wrong. I was immediately scared. I just knew something was wrong, and she put me in the car. She literally, grabbed me by the arm and put me in the back seat, and I think, Maybe she had a little bag already back there. Maybe she had met him. And I just remember that I was crying and I was very upset about it, obviously, for all those reasons. And I remember kind of, there were two ways we could go. One was to the beach and the other was to the bay. And I remember we were going across the Bay Bridge, and we didn't always go that way. We always went to the beach. And so I was lost and scared and I didn't know where I was. And later on, a few years later, they joked about it, and recalled how I was so scared in the back seat, and that my stepfather said, if I didn't stop crying, he was going to put me on the side of the interstate and leave me. And for them, it was a big joke. They really diminished the experience, like it wasn't just jarring and life-shattering for a little boy. And there was no real, this is why I'm leaving explanation. There was really no, I believe they had divorced at that point, but were still living together. My dad might have just gotten back from jail in Mariana. So I think, that was sort of the circumstance. She'd met my stepdad. She was, waiting tables in a bar, and she had a type, and he was her type. And the thing about this is, he had just gotten out of prison himself for robbing a liquor store, which he said he didn't know anything about. They never do. And he had taken a bullet to the side of his head that impacted his speech center. So he was not able to speak and complete sentences, which is very scary for a little boy that's, very wound up and tight. And so the words, like when he couldn't say a word or he would miss a word, he would replace the word GD with the word. So he would say, take GD food, GD bathroom, and as a little boy, you've got to kind of learn how to speak his language and understand what he's saying. Sorry, I know that's a lot. There you go.
Yeah. Okay. So you knew immediately this wasn't just, hey, we're gonna drive to the park. You knew that this was and your brain may have protected you, with saying, hey, this is just mom taking you someplace. But you knew automatically what was going on as far as, I don't think I'll be going back home.
I knew I wasn't going back home. It didn't matter how much I cried and begged and squealed, I was not going back home.
So, what was the new chapter of your life like after you disappeared from your father?
We lived in a couple of various trailer parks. I was nonverbal for about a year. I didn't speak to them at home.
Okay,
This,
nonverbal.
yeah.
So you had no conversation with them at all or anybody.
I would not talk to them. I'm sure at school I probably interacted with a teacher or,
Yeah.
with kids, but at home, nonverbal, completely would not speak.
Wow.
The silent treatment was the only weapon I had as a little boy. That was
So
it.
you're letting them know right up front you're displeased with this.
But yeah, they didn't care. I could have screamed or been silent about it. Either way, it was falling on deaf ears.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
And I think there were some feeble attempts of my mother trying to put me and my stepfather together to bond or do something. And I just remember, like she'd send us somewhere and I would just stare out the window. Just stare out the window and just disassociate from the entire event. Just wait for it to, just wait for it to be over. And it was just strange, because I just never understood why I wasn't with my dad anymore. I didn't understand what was going on. It just was never explained to me, and it was just such a weird sort of a mystery and a time for me as a little boy.
So, do you find still that you fade away when things are happening around you, that you didn't understand or didn't want to accept or didn't want to pretend was reality? And you were just, or was it just during that time with your mom and dad, or did it affect the way you grew up and possibly are living your life right now?
Definitely trust issues, to your
Yeah.
point. I mean, full stop. And I want to trust people. It's just they've shown me the worst that they can be already, and so it's really hard for me to give them much of a chance. And I know everyone's not the same, right? But I definitely created a world inside my head, a world of imagination. And I would draw and do little spaceships and make superheroes. And I fell in love with the TV show Star Trek, and so that was a way for me to sort of disassociate, and that kind of started my love of sci-fi. And so, I could go outside and play by myself and sort of be in these imaginary worlds that were safe for me, and I was drawing things that were safe for me. And so, that was always the place that I would go when everything felt a little bouncy for me, or when the abuse got too much. And often it was too much.
Tell you what, we're going to take our only commercial break. 888-627-6008. On the other side of this, Tim, I really want to find out what happened after now that you're gone. A couple places in a couple trailer parks. And then what's going on up here and emotionally with guilt, shame. What if I did those big what ifs? We're going to talk about all that and the rest of this story on the other side of this break. 888-627-6008. We'll be back in about 64 seconds. Count it. We'll be right back. Hang with us.
Get ready for a life-changing journey. From the best-selling author of Shattered by the Darkness and When the Dark Clouds Come, Dr. Gregory Williams is back with his highly anticipated third book, Embracing Your Scars, learning how to turn life's pain into life's power and purpose. Have you ever wondered how to transform your struggles into strength? Do you want to stop hiding behind the pain, the heartache, and instead learn how to turn those scars into the very fuel that propels you towards greatness? If you do, then this book is for you. In Embracing Your Scars, Dr. Williams shows you how to take the negative experiences of your past and turn them into the very source of your future success. Don't miss out, because your transformation begins here. The book is available soon on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and wherever great books are sold.
Welcome back to Breaking the Silence. We have Tim Smith with us, the author of the book that just came out a few months ago called Fault Line. And go ahead and hold that book up one more time so everybody can recognize that when they see it on Amazon. It's hardback, right?
Yes,
Yeah, I got
hardback.
mine on Kindle, but it's great to have a hardback. There's nothing better than actually having a book in your hand. I
I
just
agree.
love that. I'm from the old school on that.
I agree.
888-627-6008. Wanted to find out from you, Tim, what else happened to you during those middle school years, junior high school years that either added to this or maybe eased some of this that was going on in your life.
Sure, absolutely. So once they'd taken me, we had moved to a couple of different trailer parks in rural towns in Florida along the Panhandle. My stepbrother, sorry, half brother, was born maybe about a year after they were married. And about the time he was born, it was almost like they had their own little family, right? And as I started to grow up, like I sort of just became a more effeminate, more sissy little boy. My body gave me away before I knew who I was. And some of the neglect started then, like my mother. I remember there was a particular cartoon I watched in the morning, the Tennessee Tuxedo cartoon,
Oh, yeah.
and I knew at the third commercial it was time for me to go to school. And so I would take the bus, and I knew that's what I was supposed to do. And I'd had an incident earlier where I used to go to the nurse with a tummy ache, and I did that for about a week, and one morning she said, "Did you have breakfast this morning?" I said, "No." "Did you have breakfast any of these mornings?" "No." And I remember very clearly, little boy, her face was sort of relieved and disgusted. And that's how I got on the free lunch programs and the free breakfast programs, and so that really sort of helped quite a bit. Along the way, as I got older, their abuse and sort of their disdain for me really, it just ramped up. They were physically abusive. They could be psychologically abusive. Sometime between fifth and sixth grade, all the boys, they sort of go through that growth spurt where you're still a little chubby. You've got those little chubby thighs, right? And I think I just look like a regular boy. And I even look back at those pictures of me, and I just look like a kid. I just look like an 11-year-old kid. And they would call me Fat Boy. And then they would ask how much I'd eaten that day. They'd always monitor my food. And then afterwards, I could hear my stepfather saying the word queer or fag like it was punctuation. And she never stopped him. And then she could start with it too, right? And so they would kind of do that combination of, shaming my body and making fun of who I was. And that made me ashamed of who I was. It made me have no confidence. It made me fearful in the world. It made me scared of everything. And it definitely made me ashamed. And I carried that shame for decades.
So how did you deal with that feeling of shame when this is when you're a child growing up, wherever you're growing up, no matter in what city, but in Florida and in these trailer parks and things of that order, and you're totally out of control with what's going on in your world. How do you deal with shame and guilt? And have you completely buried that?
I don't know that I dealt with it as a child. I don't know that I knew how to deal with it. I think I just carried it.
Yeah.
Through my teenage years, it definitely was
That
still
gets
there.
heavy, doesn't it?
Oh yeah, for sure. And then especially like how it is when you're a teenager, like the hormones alone, right? Like that's just enough. And then you sort of see other people, like you'll see, friends driving to school in their new cars or their pretty clothes. And my homecoming outfit came from the Family Dollar, and it's hard not to feel like you're less than other people in those circumstances. And you kind of start to believe those messages, and you start to believe those visuals that you see around you. And I carried that with me probably from my 20s and 30s, if I'm being, really honest. Now I work in, to pay the bills, I work in private equity, and I support our C-suite. And the first, year there, I was like, "Wow, trailer park kid next to the Monsanto factory. What are you doing working in Beverly Hills?" And that was sort of in my head. And it took me a minute to really say, "You're as good as everybody else here because you're here. You're in the same parking lot. You're in the same building. You're in the same offices. You're just as good as everybody else." And it took me a few years to really get that message to myself that I'm as good as everybody else. That all those things, all those dark years, all that stuff is not me. It's not a part of me. It doesn't affect me. It's not who I am.
Yeah.
Much to what you were saying about some of your earlier rules about telling the truth and telling the truth to yourself, and part of that truth to yourself is that you are as good as everybody else. You are worthy. You're not less than.
So did you deal with that when you found yourself in Beverly Hills, or did you think that all along when you were buying your homecoming outfit at Family Dollar or whatever, and people probably bullying you, and bullying is a big thing today. It happened every day at school when we were
Well, of
kids.
course.
I mean, let's face it, the teachers would bully the PE coaches were terrible. I mean, that they were everybody would laugh. He was like a comedian making fun of, oh, where'd you get those shorts at, Greg? That type of thing. And then everybody'd laugh, and then they moved to the chubby person or whatever. But how did you finally figure out that, hey, here I am going through life and you're putting things in different rooms in your head, that this young person has great value, even though you had parents that didn't quite know how to love you, how to take care of you. Have you come to grips with that fully in your world still?
I'm going to say 95%, right? Like 95%, which I think is great because maybe 10, 15 years ago, it was 50%. And some of the sort of believing more in myself and sort of not having shame is just sort of, I think one of the themes that are present in my book, Fault Lines Still Standing, is hope and sort of believing in yourself and sort of going, there's got to be something better. There must be something better. Let's keep going. And so as like I kind of went through life, things like I went from, working at the Waffle House as a cook and working in shipyards in Virginia Beach to getting a very low level clerical job, right? Or working in retail. Like it was a gradual step up. And then, I feel like one day I sort of opened my eyes to my own life and was like, oh, look at this thing you've created, like it's stable and it's safe and it's got love in it and things are good and no one's going to hurt you. And it was almost like this sort of realization to myself, look what you made, look how great it is, look what you created,
So when you work through probably for all these years, even though you're quiet about them for 45 years plus, could you ever look back on and ask yourself the question, I wonder what made mom the way she was? I wonder what got dad disconnected from being a father. And not, helping other people instead of just dealing with his own issues. Have you ever questioned that or thought back what formed them, what caused this? And does that give you any comfort, or does it just give you, well, they all had issues too?
Half and half. I definitely, once I sort of went through the book and sort of, being in therapy and really examining my own feelings helped me to examine their feelings, if that makes sense. And then I was able to kind of really put her patterns together. And I realized that I don't think that she herself ever felt secure in her life, in herself. I think she lacked self-confidence. I think she felt ugly, and I think she felt less than. And so her way of lifting herself up was to put me down or to put other people down. And I think a lot of it was fear. Like she lived in her fear body. And, we live in the panhandle of Florida, and your friends are snickering saying that your son is gay and they're calling him a queer. And instead of sort of being, offensive about it, she gets defensive about it and gets, afraid because she's ashamed of it. She doesn't know how to handle it herself, right? And as far as my dad, I think so many people have reached out and said they were really rooting for my dad. They really were hoping he was going to come through. They're really hoping he was going to. And I just don't think he had it in him. I think he really wanted to be a dad. I think he enjoyed the 36 hours we spent together once every 2 or 3 months as being a dad, but I just don't think he was able to do more. And I think that he wanted to. He just didn't know how to. He just didn't know how to.
So in your therapy, did you ever do like EMDR?
No, we did not.
It didn't work for me. I just wondered, I always ask that question for people. So it's just a direct counseling back and forth.
Yeah, absolutely. And he was, I mean, just when you get a good therapist, you've got a good therapist. And
Number one, that's hard to do, right?
oh my gosh, it really is so hard. And then for someone like me too, as well, that's very guarded and untrusting. And then all of a sudden, like I've got to spill the grossest stuff to you that even I sometimes turn a blind eye to. It's scary and intimidating and. Sometimes we wouldn't say anything and we would just stare across the screen. And then I can be a little bit of a smart aleck sometimes, right? And so I'd say, do you get an extra $25 for every minute of silence, right? Right. And, he would just hold the silence and hold the space for me. And then, I'd pull it out, whatever it was, and it was absolutely horribly wonderful all at the same time. The experience of being in therapy and tackling some of these things.
How many years did you go to therapy before you finally found the right one?
I had had a therapist. It was actually quite good, maybe in my early 20s. It was after my mother had died. My dad was still alive. My mother's ashes had sort of showed up one day in the mail, and was hard for me to find words or thoughts for all of that. And so I ended up doing, this was in the 90s, ended up on, the Prozac, Seroquel, blah, 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 cocktail to sort of, clamp down what they thought was my bipolar depression at the time. I had a great therapist who was very, open to hearing all of my, whatever it was at the time, which I think was very unfocused. Because I think at the time I was unfocused in my early 20s. I was very, a little bit like a firecracker, because I didn't know how to not be a firecracker. I always had to be half cocked, as my husband likes to say. Because growing up like we grew up, we're always scanning for danger.
Did you ever stand on the emotional ledge and wanting to take a dive?
Sure, and did. When my mother died, we had September 11th, and though I wasn't, I wasn't there, it had nothing really to do with me. It was a very, jarring is not even the word. It just displaced my psyche so bad seeing those events. And I got fired from my job like right after that. So it was like a August, September, October. And I have to tell you, like, I think I just shut down. It was just like, no. Yeah, and I just shut down for a year and went to the library. They were still pretty popular then, and kind of started randomly. I don't know if I was led to it or how I got there, but started looking for religions and just sort of went from there. And it just sort of helped me try to find some meaning to my chaos, to the world's chaos, to the chaos I'd experienced. And that really helped.
Did the book become therapy for you?
It did.
As you wrote it, yeah, it's something just to write it, whether to then let it out to the world. That's a whole different event, but it is therapeutic, isn't it?
It is.
What
It
surprised you the
is
most?
how easily I could have sometimes got trapped in those moments and in those things. There was a moment I had a little PTSD, here in my house. I was writing about the book and probably was just in the thought of it. And I remember I was frozen mid walk out the door. And in the past few years, I've done yoga and therapy. I'm sorry, yoga and meditation. And I guess some fail-safe or some trigger in my mind said, feel your heart beating, breathe, like feel the air in your lungs, feel your feet on the ground. And so it brought me back to the present. It got me out of my head, which sometimes I think you can agree is not always the best place to be. Let's be in our bodies more.
Emotionally, take me back to where, let's say, you're the cook at Waffle House, and the waiter screams out, because I think back in those Waffle House, at least around here, they don't write the orders down, they just yell them out. It's like, how do they keep that straight? Let's just think right now that you have somebody's listening to the program and yelling out an order to you. Make me an order of peace.
Right.
What would you put on that grill
I.
emotionally to be able to let them know by the time you're done with this is going to give you the plate that you've asked for? What is that key, those keys, those ingredients to make peace?
I love that question. I think one of the ingredients is you've got to believe in yourself. You've got to find who you are, whatever that is, right? Like you've got to find who you are. And then, my ingredients for peace is one, like I said, knowing who I am, having stability in my life, having routine in my life, knowing that there are there's love in my life, that I'm in a relationship, that I have a safe place to be, that I have dogs, that I have those things. And peace for me isn't always about like money or success or world trips. It's really about that feeling of taking a nap on your couch on a Sunday afternoon when it's raining. That is the feeling I would want to give peace. That's what I would cook up for people on the grill.
If there's somebody that's listening to the program, go, hey, wait, 45 years is nothing. I'm hitting 51 years of this. What do you highly recommend those listeners that's watching you right now around the world to say, hey, give this a chance, try this. This helped me. What would be a few things if you could look in their eyes right now and tell them, give this a chance?
Absolutely, and that's another good question. The first thing is you've got to be brave. You've got to be braver than you ever thought you could be, and you're going to be like a phoenix, and you're going to be better than you ever thought you were going to be. But first, you've got to burn, and the burning is painful. And in some cases, you've got to get used to the pain and know that the pain is there and it's a part of you, but it is not you, that you control that. It doesn't control you. And another thing I would say is to take back your power. Take back your power from the narrative in your head that's told you something that is just not true, from the voices of your parents that were neglective or abusive. Take back your power from a circumstance or from a place or from a past that is not you, and give your power to things that lift you up, that encourage you, and that support you.
Wow, good answers. Good answer. I
Thank
tell
you.
you what. Hold up your book one more time. We're running out
Absolutely.
of time there. There's the book. If people want to get a hold of you, Tim, what will be the best way for them to? Do you have a website? Do you have an
Yes.
email? What's the best way for them to get in touch with you? Maybe to come and speak? Are you doing speeches yet about the book?
If
And
someone wants me to, I'm happy to do it.
okay.
Absolutely.
And how would they get a hold of you?
Sure. You can go to faultlinememoir.com, and that
Huh.
has my contact information there. I also have an Instagram page for this book, tim.smith.writes.
Okay, very good. And our wonderful TJ at the radio station will put all of that in underneath the banner, the show on the station, so they have all the access to those links right there if you didn't
Wonderful.
get them wrote down. Thank you so much for being with me, Tim, and thank you for
Thank you, Greg.
allowing me to make a mistake about last week, but I'm so glad that we connected this week. Is that your mom's picture behind you?
That is actually Queen Elizabeth.
Okay, I thought
But on this is my mother. This is her, and this is
Oh, that's her
me.
there. Okay.
That's us when we were in Prattville, Alabama, and my dad took the picture. And so I thought it really worked, like he's in the picture. He took the picture, but he's not in the picture. And
Right.
then we're kind of separated, and we're both just sort of doing our own thing. And I saw the photo, I was going through stuff, and I was like, that's the one.
Is that a cotton
That's the
field?
cover. Yes, it's Cottonfield in Alabama. We used to go and pick cotton, and I don't know, do before they separated. Yeah.
Wow. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you,
Love to have
Greg.
you back. If you need the book, want the book, just get on Amazon right now. You can literally download it off Kindle and you can be reading in the next 15 minutes. It's a highly recommended, good reading. So appreciate it, Tim. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Greg.
Like we always like to do each and every week. And I think tonight's show was an absolute scenario that just full circles this very point right here that I always close with each and every week. No matter what's going on, no matter what's happened to you, no matter what your brain has told you to not reveal because it's just trying to protect you, flight, fright, freeze, flop, whatever it is that it's telling you to do, it's there to try to keep you safe, and you're just running and you're confused. Want to let you know, there's always hope. There's always hope. And this book tells about it. It tells you how to experience it, tells you how to find it. And it's literally the whole definition that you can go through this and still come out all right at the far end. And Fault Line is a book that you ought to get. There's always hope. Never forget that. Join us right here next week for another live edition from the awesome, look, the sun went down here from the awesome city of Houston, Texas. And we're battling for first place with LA, but here we are. But I do want to let you know it's 100 degrees here right now. So LA may be the place to be. But anyway, join us right here for another edition of Breaking the Silence. God bless you. Have an awesome, awesome week and never give up on hope. On hope. We'll see you next week. God bless. Good night.
Thank you for listening to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. To contact Dr. Williams, dial 832-396-6525 or email him at shatteredbythedarkness@gmail.com. And don't forget to join us each Sunday night at 8 p.m. Central Time, 6 p.m. Pacific on BBS Radio Station 1. For the next episode of Breaking the Silence.